The statement I'm about to make is not an earth-shattering or newsworthy statement. It's not something you don't already know. In fact, you and I both feel the effects of this statement every day, moment by moment, in our relationships, in our work, even in the thoughts that swirl around in our own heads. And the statement is this: we live in a broken world. See, I told you, this is not brand new information. In fact, this is the very definition of current reality as we know it. And I think we might all agree that in recent years, it seems that the brokenness of our world just continues to amplify. At the time that I'm writing this, we're still living in the shadow of the COVID-19 pandemic. War has broken out in certain areas of the world. The slightest glance at any news article, broadcast, or tweet can easily elicit fear, anger, even dissension. Political chaos abounds. There's tribalism, human trafficking, terrorism, corruption in government and corporate leadership. There are hurricanes, wildfires, and that's just on a large global scale. I'm sure in your own personal lives, it's likely you feel the effects of this world's brokenness even more acutely. As you experience the loss of loved ones, family tension and hardship, an estranged relative, a child who continues running from the Lord, financial difficulties, health problems, discontentment in your work, depression, anxiety, disillusionment with how life has unfolded thus far. I mean, I do not have to tell you what you already know. We live in a broken world. And our world is broken because it is fallen. Or another way to say it, our world is broken because of sin. Sin is the problem. Not necessarily a specific sin in your life or mine, but just simply in general, sin has broken our world. And yet, though a broken world damaged by sin is our current reality, Christians know that that's not the end of the story. And today, as we complete our study of the book of Jeremiah, I think we're all going to be pleasantly surprised at how poignantly this book speaks to this very reality. The reality of the brokenness of our world, the damage sin has caused, and the reality that hope still remains. Last week in our lesson, we were introduced to Jeremiah the man. Who was he? What did he experience, and what was he called by God to do? Along the way, we were also briefly introduced to Jeremiah's message. Specifically, we looked at many of the overarching themes that pervade his message. And now this week, I want to continue in that same vein. We're going to dive even more deeply into Jeremiah's message, and as we do, we'll not only explore how Jeremiah's message applied to his original audience, we'll also ultimately explore and we'll see just how much Jeremiah's message applies to you and to me and our world today. All right. So first off, a little groundwork. Remember last week we said that Jeremiah chapter 1 verse 10 was Jeremiah's job description, where God outlined six tasks for Jeremiah's ministry. God said to Jeremiah, "See, today I appoint you over nations and kingdoms to uproot and tear down, to destroy and overthrow, to build and to plant." And so this verse, Jeremiah 1:10, this is an important verse. This verse now sets the stage for the entire rest of the book of Jeremiah. Inherent in this verse are the two major themes of Jeremiah's ministry: judgment and grace, or judgment and hope. Or judgment and restoration. In judgment, God appointed Jeremiah over nations to uproot and tear down, to destroy and overthrow. But that's not the end of the story. Because in grace, God also appointed Jeremiah over nations to build and to plant. And so what we very literally see in this verse is that God's grace, not God's judgment, will have the last word. There is hope of restoration after judgment. And that, in a nutshell, is the entire message of the book of Jeremiah. If we want to say it a bit more succinctly, we can say it like this: God can restore what sin has damaged. God can restore what sin has damaged. That is the message of Jeremiah. God can restore what sin has damaged. And today we're going to sweep through almost the entire book of Jeremiah simply to explore this one very powerful truth. And we're going to do so using two divisions, all right? So division number one, we'll see damage done. This is Jeremiah chapters 2 to 29. And then in division number two, we'll see hope of restoration to come. This is Jeremiah chapters 30 to 52. All right, so damage done, but there is hope of restoration to come because it is true. God can restore what sin has damaged. It's a powerful, powerful truth, all right? So let's get started. Beginning with our first division, damage done, we're looking at Jeremiah chapters 2 to 29. And in these chapters, we find several of Jeremiah's sermons from the earlier portion of his ministry before the exile and before God's judgment came to his people. And essentially, the focus of Jeremiah's message in these chapters is that God is bringing charges against his people. God's people have sinned against God. They have broken covenant with God. And so God, in these chapters, he is simply exposing his people's sin and proving his people's guilt, the damage done. And just as we've seen throughout every other prophet we've studied this year, there are essentially three main overarching indictments that God brings against his people, or three main overarching sins that God exposes in his people. And these three sins are just as relevant today as they were in Jeremiah's day. The three sins are these: idolatry, injustice, and empty religion. Idolatry, lack of love for God. Injustice, lack of love for other people, and empty religion, which results from a lack of love for God and others. And so looking at these chapters, Jeremiah chapters 2 to 29, let's see what God has to say about each of these three sins. First, looking at the sin of idolatry. God, who had faithfully called and chosen the people of Judah to be in a covenant relationship with himself, he says, in return, his people have strayed from him, they have followed worthless idols, and as a result, they have become worthless themselves. Verses 10 to 13 in chapter 2 highlight the sin of idolatry most explicitly. In these verses, God actually highlights and contrasts the faithfulness of foreign pagan nations against the unfaithfulness of his own people. In verses 10 to 13 of chapter 2, God says, "Cross over to the coasts of Cyprus and look, send to Kedar and observe closely. See if there has ever been anything like this. Has a nation ever changed its gods? Yet they are no gods at all. But my people have exchanged their glorious God for worthless idols. Be appalled at this, you heavens, and shudder with great horror," declares the Lord. "My people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and they have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water." In other words, the people of God, though they had complete access to the full resources of the one true God, the spring of living water, they instead turned away to worthless substitutes, foreign gods and idols who were powerless to meet their deep spiritual needs. In your lesson questions this week, you read several additional passages that continue to highlight Judah's almost insatiable sin of idolatry. Passages like chapter 2, verses 23 to 25, where God compares his people to a wild donkey in heat, craving the attention of other foreign gods. Or chapter 3, verse 13, where God pleads with his people, saying, "Only acknowledge your guilt. You have rebelled against the Lord your God. You have scattered your favors to foreign gods under every spreading tree and have not obeyed me," declares the Lord. So first and foremost, God's people were guilty of the sin of idolatry. And this alone was the ultimate betrayal of the covenant relationship God had established with his people, but yet the people's sin did not stop there. Alongside flagrant idolatry, God also exposed among his people sins of injustice. For example, in chapter 5, verse 1, God said this about Jerusalem. He said, "If you can find but one person who deals honestly and seeks the truth, then I will forgive this city. However, although they say, 'As surely as the Lord lives,' still they are swearing falsely." Then further down in the same chapter, chapter 5, verses 26 to 28, God again says, among my people are the wicked who lie in wait like men who snare birds and like those who set traps to catch people. Like cages full of birds, their houses are full of deceit. They have become rich and powerful and have grown fat and sleek. Their evil deeds have no limit. They do not seek justice. They do not promote the case of the fatherless. They do not defend the just cause of the poor. So injustice and corruption permeated the civilian population of God's people, but that's not all. Injustice and corruption also permeated every level of leadership within the community of God's people. From kings to prophets to priests to politicians, all of them were corrupt. God says in chapter 5, verse 31, the prophets prophesy lies, the priests rule by their own authority, and my people love it this way. Okay, so God has proven his people are guilty of the sin of idolatry. They are guilty of the sin of injustice. And now finally, God will prove his people are guilty of the sin of empty religion. In chapter 7, God told Jeremiah, go stand at the gate of the Lord's house, the temple, and proclaim this message. And from there, throughout the entirety of Jeremiah chapter 7, we read Jeremiah's sermon at the temple, which is a sermon that explicitly exposes the people's empty, false religion. Starting in verse 4 of chapter 7, God, through Jeremiah, warned the people. He said, do not trust in deceptive words and say, this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. In other words, the people had become preoccupied with checking the religious boxes, saying the right words, reciting ritualistic, formulaic chants, very much in a superstitious way. And then Jeremiah continued. He said, if you really change your ways and your actions and deal with each other justly, if you do not oppress the foreigner, the fatherless, or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not follow other gods to your own harm, then I, the Lord, will let you live in this place, in the land I gave your ancestors forever and ever. But look, you are trusting in deceptive words that are worthless. So, okay, Judah's guilt has been duly proven by God. Though God, through Jeremiah, warned his people time and time again and pleaded with his people to repent, they refused. The people's guilt mounted as their sins multiplied. And ultimately, because of the people's sin, specifically the sins of idolatry, injustice, and empty religion, God's people broke their covenant with God. Damage was done. Judgment now was coming. And sure enough, in Jeremiah chapter 25, starting in verse 3, Jeremiah unveils the details of God's coming judgment. He says, for 23 years, the word of the Lord has come to me, and I've spoken to you again and again, but you have not listened. And then he goes on to say, therefore, the Lord Almighty says this, because you have not listened to my words, I will summon all the peoples of the north and my servant Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and I will bring them against this land and its inhabitants and against all the surrounding nations. I will completely destroy them and make them an object of horror and scorn and an everlasting ruin. This whole country will become a desolate wasteland, and these nations will serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Damage was done. Because of sin, God's people broke their covenant with God, and now judgment was coming. And so that leads to our first principle. Sin damages all that is good. Sin damages all that is good. No matter how enticing a particular sin may seem, no matter how harmless or innocent a particular sin may seem, know that it is not. Sin shatters lives. Sin shatters dreams. Sin shatters relationships and reputations. Sin damages all that is good. And so in what area of your life are you tempted to rationalize your sin? In today's culture, even among Christians, there are many respectable sins. Sins that are subtle and therefore easily tolerated and even sometimes accepted or assumed. Sins like jealousy, gossip, pride, greed, materialism. Do not be fooled. Sin, all sin, Seemingly major sin, minor sin, not so subtle sin, all sin in some way, shape, or form, all sin damages all that is good. And the people of Judah knew this truth all too well. Because of their sin, because of Judah's sin, damage was done. God's covenant was broken. But one outstanding feature of the book of Jeremiah is Jeremiah's elaboration of God's intention to restore what sin has damaged. Because remember Jeremiah 1:10? It's God's grace, not God's judgment, that has the last word. So though, yes, for the people of Judah, God's people, damage was done, but still, hope of restoration to come remained. And so that's the title of our second division, Hope of Restoration to Come. We're now stepping into the latter half of the book of Jeremiah, chapters 30 to 52. And as we do, we're going to see Jeremiah is going to highlight for us three reasons why God's people, the people of Judah, could have hope of God's restoration to come. Despite their sin, despite the very real damage that was done because of their sin, God's people could still have hope because of these three reasons that Jeremiah highlights. Reason number one, God's people could still have hope because God will establish a new covenant. We're going to see this in Jeremiah chapters 30 to 33. Reason number two, God's people could still have hope because God's enemies will be defeated. This is Jeremiah chapters 46 to 51. And then finally, reason number three, God's people could still have hope because God's remnant will remain. This is Jeremiah chapter 52. Three reasons why God's people can still have hope. And we're going to walk through each of these three reasons right now, starting with reason number one, God's people could still have hope because God will establish a new covenant. Again, this is Jeremiah chapters 30 to 33. And as we approach these chapters and this concept of God's new covenant, I think it might be wise if we first review the nature of God's covenant relationship with his people. Okay, so this is God's covenant people that Jeremiah is speaking to. In other words, this is the people to whom God pledged himself, starting all the way back in the book of Genesis. God initiated a covenant or a promise or a partnership with this people. It's called the Abrahamic covenant. And at that time, God said to Abraham and to Abraham's descendants, who would later become the people of Israel and Judah, God said, "I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." In other words, by grace, God chose Abraham and his descendants to be his people, to experience his blessing, the blessing of being in relationship with him and representing him in the world. Okay, so then fast forward a few centuries to the books of Exodus and Deuteronomy. As a part of this same covenant relationship, this same partnership, God then revealed to his people how to best experience his blessing and how to best represent him in the world. He said, "If you obey my law, you will experience blessing. But if you disobey my law, you will experience harm." This is called the Mosaic Covenant. But now, as we have literally combed through the entire book of Jeremiah, we've seen God's people, they refuse to obey God. They refuse to submit to God's authority. They refuse to live by God's law. So that means that by their actions, God's people have broken God's covenant, opted out of God's blessing, and essentially said, "We do not want to be the people of God." Interesting. Okay, so now, what was God to do? Here he is. He has called and chosen by grace a people who really do not want to be his people. So should he just walk away, give up, utterly reject his people forever? He had every right to do that, you know. God was the innocent party in this broken covenant relationship. Damage was done. He had every right to utterly reject his people forever. However, He did not have the ability to reject his people forever. Why? Because he gave his word. Again, way back in the book of Genesis, the Abrahamic covenant, God said, I will bless you. Not because of anything you have done or will do, but because I freely choose you by grace. Remember, it's God's grace, not God's judgment, that has the last word. God is faithful and true. He cannot go back on his word, so he could not reject his people forever. Instead, God, in eternity past, determined the only option. He would not reject his people. Instead, he would bring about a new covenant. His people broke the old Mosaic covenant, so now God is going to bring about a new and better covenant. And that's exactly what Jeremiah now introduces to us in Jeremiah chapters 30 to 33, God's new covenant. And for the sake of time, I want to zoom in on just four verses from these chapters. These are four very significant verses. They were significant for God's people during Jeremiah's day, and they remain significant for God's people today. So that means if you've placed your faith in Jesus Christ, these verses apply to you, okay? So here it is, God's new covenant, Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 31 to 34. It says, "The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and with the people of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they broke that covenant, though I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will make with the people of Israel after that time. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. No longer will they teach their neighbor or say to one another, 'Know the Lord,' because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more." These verses are utterly central to what Christians believe. God's promise in these verses was set in motion through the life, death, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus Christ. And God's promise in these verses will be fully fulfilled at the second coming of Jesus Christ. It is by faith alone in Christ who shed his blood for you and for me on the cross. It is by faith in him that you and I enter God's new covenant, a new and better covenant. But so now, how is this new covenant better than the old Mosaic covenant? Well, in these verses, we see three key attributes that guarantee God's new covenant is better than the old Mosaic covenant. So let's run through them quickly. Starting with attribute number one, in these verses, we see God's new covenant is unbreakable. Or another way to say this, God's new covenant is unconditional. We see this in verse 32. As God said, "This new covenant will not be like the old covenant that I made with your ancestors when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they broke that covenant." So in other words, if the new covenant is not like the old covenant, which broke, that means the new covenant is unbreakable or unconditional. Sin cannot break or damage God's new covenant. Okay, so God's new covenant is unbreakable. That's attribute number one. Now, attribute number two, God's new covenant is internalized. We see this in verse 33. God says, "I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God and they will be my people." Okay, so this is important. From this verse, we learn that though God is bringing about a new covenant, that does not mean God is abolishing his law. There is nothing wrong with God's law. God's law is God's perfect standard of righteousness. God's law simply reveals what God values. So the problem, even with the old Mosaic covenant, the problem was never God's law. The problem was always sin. And so now in the new covenant, God still upholds his law. But this time around, he says, "I will now write my law on their hearts, so that by nature, by a new nature, my people will long to obey my law and represent me well in the world." Later in the Old Testament, we will learn through the book of Ezekiel that God will accomplish this by his Holy Spirit, who even now indwells every believer in Jesus Christ. Okay, so God's new covenant is unbreakable, it's internalized, and finally, attribute number three, God's new covenant is inclusive. We see this in verse 34, where God says, "No longer will they teach their neighbor or say to one another, 'Know the Lord,' because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord, for I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more." There is no partiality or favoritism with the Lord. All believers in Jesus Christ, no matter your background, education, nationality, skin color, social status, all believers in Jesus Christ are indwelt by God's Holy Spirit and therefore given both the desire and the ability to obey God's law. And so, do you know what that means? That means that through God's new covenant, God has ensured that all the blessings that he always longed to pour out on his people, the blessing that he first promised through the Abrahamic covenant when he said, "I will bless you." And then he revealed through the Mosaic covenant how to experience that blessing when he said, "If you obey my law, you will experience blessing." But the people refused because of sin. Now, under the new covenant, God has ensured it will happen. God has ensured obedience will happen. He's ensured law-keeping will happen so that his people, so that we may experience the blessing, the joy, the beauty, the freedom of a life lived in step with him, both now and ultimately, completely in eternity. That is the significance of God's new covenant. And that is only reason number one as to why God's people still have hope of restoration to come. It's because God will and in fact has established his new covenant. All right, now reason number two. Jeremiah encouraged the people of God to have hope because God's enemies will be defeated. We're now moving into Jeremiah chapters 46 to 51. We're going to skip over Jeremiah chapters 34 to 45 because we looked at those chapters last week. Here in chapters 46 to 51, we see Jeremiah addressing 10 different nations. And each of these 10 nations historically were nations that intentionally set themselves up against God as enemies of God and enemies of God's people. In these chapters, we see Jeremiah address Egypt, who, if you recall, enslaved God's people for 400 years. He addresses Philistia, who were the Philistines of David and Goliath. Through Goliath, the Philistines tried to murder God's anointed King David. He also addresses Moab, Ammon, Edom, Damascus, Kedar and Hazar, Elam, and Babylon. Each of these nations, in specific ways and at specific times in history, sought to destroy the people of God. And so these verses and chapters would have brought comfort and encouragement to God's people to know that God remained their defender and that he would ultimately save them from their enemies. And while some of these passages may seem severe as God destroys his enemies, we need to remember that God is perfectly just. And so therefore, it is good and right for God to judge and even defeat his enemies. And yet, however, at the same time, if we look closely at these verses, we'll see that even in God's dealings with his enemies, still, it's God's grace, not God's judgment, that has the last word. We see this very literally in many of these verses and chapters. Take Egypt, for example. In chapter 46, verse 26, God concludes his message of judgment for Egypt by saying, "Later, however," meaning after judgment, "Egypt will be inhabited as in times past." Or again, in his message to Moab in chapter 48, verse 47, God concludes his message of judgment for Moab by saying, "Yet I will restore the fortunes of Moab in days to come." Or again, for Ammon in chapter 49, verse 6, God concludes, "Yet afterward, after judgment, I will restore the fortunes of the Ammonites." And same thing too for Elam. In chapter 49, verse 39, God concludes, "Yet I will restore the fortunes of Elam in days to come." So that is reason number two as to why God's people could still have hope. It's because God's enemies will be judged and defeated. And yet even in that judgment, God's grace will still have the last word. Okay, so we've walked through reason number one, God's people could still have hope because God will establish a new covenant. Reason number two was God's people could still have hope because God's enemies will be defeated. And now finally, reason number three, God's people, the people of Judah, could still have hope of God's restoration to come because God's remnant will remain. We are now stepping into the final chapter of the book of Jeremiah, chapter 52. And this is a sobering chapter. Alongside Jeremiah chapter 39, this chapter, chapter 52, depicts the fall of Jerusalem and God's judgment on his people. After damage was done, after God's people broke their covenant with God because of their sin, God's judgment has now finally arrived. And yet, even in the very throes of judgment, in the final verses of this final chapter of the book of Jeremiah, we are given a glimmer of hope as we see God's remnant will remain. Let's look quickly at the final four verses of Jeremiah chapter 52. In these verses, we learn that Judah's king Jehoiakim had been captured and imprisoned in Babylon for nearly four decades. However, now a new king of Babylon is coming to power, and this new king has determined to set Jehoiakim free. So let's look, starting in verse 32 of chapter 52, it says, "The king of Babylon spoke kindly to Jehoiakim and gave him a seat of honor higher than those of the other kings who were with him in Babylon. So Jehoiakim put aside his prison clothes and for the rest of his life ate regularly at the king's table." So now, why is this significant? Well, fast forward to the New Testament, Matthew chapter 1, as Matthew is reciting the genealogy of Jesus Christ, we read in verse 12, "After the exile to Babylon, Jeconiah, that is Jehoiakim, was the father of Shealtiel, who was the father of Zerubbabel, who ultimately was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus." Even in the throes of judgment, God did not forget his promise to his people to provide a savior and a king. It is God's grace, not God's judgment, that has the last word. So yes, for the people of Judah, damage was done. And yes, for the people of Judah, judgment did come. Yet, after judgment, there was and still remains hope of restoration to come because of Jesus. He is the initiator and mediator of God's new covenant. He is the victor over all God's enemies, sin, Satan, and death. Because of Jesus, through his life, death, and resurrection, we have hope. As an anchor for the soul, we have hope that God's restoration will come. So that leads to our second and final principle. God can and will restore what sin has damaged. God can and will restore what sin has damaged. It's grace, not judgment, that has the last word. And that is the message of the prophet Jeremiah.